The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I was trying to explain to somebody before I came here that this book is unusual in the sense that, although like all the others, it's based on the political situation as it evolved from 1934 to 1942, this book is a child of chronology. And I would really like for you to believe that I have this incredibly shrewd, overseeing mastermind. But it's not only not true of me, it's generally not true of writers. And you know, there's the great Neil Simon line in one of his plays that goes, it's about a writer, and it goes, "I'm on page 181 and I don't have an idea yet." You may laugh, but that isn't necessarily untrue. Anyhow, what I discovered, and I kind of did discover it, maybe I knew it subconsciously as I tried to write this particular book, but I discovered a really very interesting is a terrible thing, or a thing worth thinking about, let's put it that way. What happened essentially is this. In October of 1940, Benito Mussolini, who was feeling really blue because he wasn't in the newsreels, Hitler was everywhere, Poland was in the Pathé newsreels with the exciting music
and the voice that went like this,
you know,
"Look at those buildings burning."
That's a quote. Mussolini was feeling really left out. And so he decided that he ought to invade Greece. You really wonder that people, any human, could make a decision like this, but so he did. He invaded Greece, and the Greeks kicked his ass thoroughly, right back up into Albania, halfway back up. And people watched this from Salonika, which is basically the Chicago of Greece. If Athens is New York, Salonika is Chicago. The sort of the burly, brawling second city and a big port. So the more they beat on Mussolini, and everybody in Salonika knew it, the more Adolf Hitler could not afford to have the Axis suffer a defeat, to show that it was vulnerable, to show that it could be beaten. So every day they knew that sooner or later the Germans were going to invade and that there was going to be nothing they could do about it. There is some element of Greek tragedy in this. There really is. And they were right. So the person that I chose, the character that I chose to observe this particular thing is a policeman, a very senior police official. I just wedged it back enough so that there's a description of his job, so I won't say it twice. But it's particularly the aspect of the policeman who is there to protect us, who is the only person who's there to protect us. When I've written scenes about Kristallnacht in 1938, the way that I got into that particular thing was to show a policeman standing on the corner and doing nothing as people committed felony after felony. It's worth thinking about it. Anyhow, let me get started. What do you need to know? Not much. We're down on the docks of Salonika, and apparently, according to a Turkish ship captain, a German civilian who was not on the manifest of the shipping company has come to Salonika on a tramp freighter. So it falls to Costazanis, the hero, to try to figure out what to do about it. This is a little bit of his history. By 1934, he was promoted to detective, and 3 years later to, technically, the rank of sub-commander, though nobody ever used that title. This advancement did not just happen by itself. an old and honored expression from the time of the Turkish occupation, said that it was most fortunate to have a Barba Sto Palati, an uncle in the palace. And it turned out, to Zanis's surprise, that he had that very thing. His particular talent, a kind of rough diplomacy, getting people to do what he wanted without hitting them, had been observed from on high by the head of the Salonika police, a near mystic presence in the city. Vangelis was at least 80 years old, some said older, with the smile of a saint. Thus, Saint Vangelis, at least to those who could appreciate irony and veneration in the same phrase. For 50 years, nothing had gone on in Salonika that the old man didn't know about, and he'd watched Zanis's career with interest. So in 1937, when Zanis decided to resign his position, Vangelis offered him a new one, his own office, a detective, a clerk, and a greatly improved salary. "I need someone to handle these matters," Vangelis told him, and went on to describe what he needed. Zanis understood right away, and in time became known to the world at large as a senior police official. But to those with knowledge of the subterranean intricacies of the city's life, and soon enough to the Salonika street, he was simply Zanis. Was the Belgian consul being blackmailed by a prostitute? Call Zanis. Had the son of an Athenian politician taken a diamond ring from a jeweler and forgotten to pay for it? Call Zanis. Did a German civilian arrive unofficially in Salonika on the freighter of a neutral nation? When Zanis walked back to the foot of the pier, he found his assistant, Gabby Saltiel, waiting for him, smoking a cigarette, leaning back in the driver's seat. Saltiel loved his car, a hard-sprung black Skoda 420 built by the Czechs for Balkan roads. "Pull over behind the wall, Gabby," Zanis said, "out of sight where we can just see the pier." Saltiel pushed the ignition button, the engine rumbled to life, and he swung the car around and headed for the customs house. A gray 55, Saltiel, tall and shambling, slump-shouldered and myopic, who viewed the world with a mixture of patience and cynicism through thick-framed eyeglasses. A Sephardic Jew from the large community in Salonika, he'd somehow become a policeman and prospered at the job because he was intelligent, sharp, very smart about people, who they really were, and persistent, a courteous, diffident bulldog. On the day that Vangelis offered Zanis the new job, saying, "and find somebody you can work with," he had telephoned Gabby Saltiel, explained what he'd be doing, and asked Saltiel to join him. "What's it called, this department?" Saltiel said. "It doesn't need a name," Zanis answered. 10 seconds passed, a long time on the telephone. Finally, Saltiel said, "When do I start?" Now Zanis headed for the taxi, gave the driver some money, thanked him, and sent him home. When Zanis slid into the passenger seat of the Skoda, Saltiel said, "So, what's going on?" Zanis repeated the port captain's story, then said, "As long as he doesn't enter the city, we leave him alone. We'll give him a few hours to do something. Then, if he's still holed up in the ship, I'll get some detectives to replace us." "What if he waits until morning, strolls down here, and shows a passport to the control officer?" "Follow him," Zanis said. "I don't want him running loose in the city." "German," you said. "Reads a German newspaper. Who knows what he is?" "A spy, you think?" "Could be." The Turkish captain more or less said he was, with a look. Saltiel laughed. "The Levant," he said. "A look indeed. I wouldn't live anywhere else." After a moment, he added, "What's a spy after in Salonika? Any idea?" "Who knows? Maybe just the war coming south." "Don't say such things, Costa. Down here at the ass end of the Balkans, who cares?" "Not Hitler, not according to the newspapers. And he has to know what goes on here up in the mountains when we're occupied." Saltiel looked thoughtful. "Still," he said. "What?" "Well, I have a nephew who teaches at the technical school, geography, among other things. A smart boy, Manny. He says that as long as Hitler stays allied with the Russians, we're safe. But if he attacks them, we could be in for it. On the map of Europe, we're the right flank. If somebody's headed east, the right flank that goes to the Caucasus for the oil. Anyhow, that's Manny's theory." "Believe it?" Saltiel shrugged. "Hitler's cunning. I wouldn't say intelligent, but cunning. Jews he attacks, Russians he leaves alone." Saltiel ducked down behind... Oops, minute. Zanis nodded. It sounded reasonable. Before I forget, he said, did you bring what I asked for? In the glove box. Zanis opened the glove box and took out a Walther PPK automatic, the German weapon preferred by Bakken detectives. There were bright metal scratches on the base of the grip. What have you been doing with this? Hanging pictures, Saltiel said. The last time I saw my hammer, one of the grandkids was playing with it. Kids, Zanis said with a smile. I'm blessed, Saltiel said. You ought to get busy, Costa. You're not getting any younger. Zanis's smile widened. With Roxanne, he said, naming his English girlfriend. Well, Saltiel said, I guess not. 8:20 p.m. It had started to rain again, a few lightning flashes out in the Aegean. You awake, Zanis said? Just barely. You want a nap? Go ahead. No thanks, maybe later. 10:30 p.m. By the way, Zanis said, did you telephone Madame Pappas this morning about 11? And she said that she hated her husband and she's glad he's dead. That's honest. I thought so. Anything else? No, she was getting ready to scream at me, so I got off the phone. You said to go easy. Zanis nodded. Let the detectives deal with him. She kill him? She did. Naughty girl. 1:15 a.m. Quiet in the city behind them. Only faint music from the tavernas on the seafront corniche and the creaking of the pier as the tide worked at the pilings. The sound was hypnotic, and Zanis fought to stay awake. He took a cigarette from the flat box in his pocket, a Papastratos number one, top of the line in Greece, and struck a wooden match alight with his thumbnail. Expensive, these things, so a luxury for him. He made good money now, Vangelis had seen to that, but good money for a cop, which wasn't very much, not with four people to feed. His younger brother, Ari, for Aristotle, sometimes made a few drachmas by carrying messages in the city. It was getting smoky in the car, and Saltiel rolled down the window. Do you think there are men on the moon? He said. I don't know. I suppose anything's possible. They were arguing about it yesterday in the barber shop. Little green men? With one eye? Like in Buck Rogers? I guess so. Somebody in your barber shop thinks those movies are true? That's what it sounded like. I'd change barbers if I were you. 3:30 a.m. Wake up, Gabby. I wasn't sleeping, not really. Here he comes. Of medium height, the man wore a raincoat and carried a briefcase. He had a hard, bony, chinless face beneath a hat with the brim tilted over his eyes. As he neared the end of the pier, Zanis and Saltiel ducked down below the windshield. By now they could hear footsteps, determined and in a hurry, that approached, then faded away from them, headed around the east side of the customs house toward the city. To the west lay the warehouse district and the railway station. Zanis made sure of the Walther in the pocket of his jacket, slid out of the passenger seat, and was careful not to slam the door, leaving it ajar. Give me 30 seconds, Gabby, he said, then follow along nice and slow, headlights off, and keep your distance. Zanis walked quickly to the east side of the customs house, paused at the corner, and had a quick look around it. Nobody. Where the hell had he gone? There was only one street he could have taken, which served the warehouses. Zanis, moving at a fast trot, reached the street, turned the corner, and there he was. Well, there somebody was, about two blocks away. Now Zanis realized he was getting wet, put up his umbrella, and moved into the shelter of the high brick wall of the first warehouse. Up ahead, the Germans sped on with long strides, as though, Zanis thought, he was taking his evening constitutional on a path in some Deutschland forest. A few seconds later, the Skoda turned the corner behind him, and Zanis signaled, waving his hand backward, for Saltiel to stay where he was. Zanis could hear the engine idling as the Skoda rolled to a stop. Could the German hear it? Doubtful, especially in the rain, but Zanis couldn't be sure. The street was dead silent. Then the German glanced over his shoulder and turned right down a narrow alley. He'd likely seen Zanis, but so what? Just a man with an umbrella, trudging along, shoulders hunched, on a miserable night. Zanis walked past the alley, ignored it, eyes on the ground ahead of him, until he passed the far corner and moved out of sight. He didn't stop there, but went farther down the street. If he could hear the German could hear him, then looked for a place to hide. He saw a loading dock across from him and moved quickly, soaking one foot in a puddle between broken cobblestones, hurried up the steps, and stood in the angle of the shuttered entryway by the wall, which was blind from the street. The German wasn't going anywhere, Zanis realized, not from this alley, where, a few years earlier, a porter had stabbed Hamid the moneylender in an argument over a few lepta, not even a drachma, and it was blocked by a high stone wall covered with a wisteria vine. Hamid had staggered as far as the wall and pulled at the wisteria, thinking to climb over, but the vine came away from the crumbling stone and he died right there. The porter covered him up with the vine, but in a few hours, it was summertime, Hamid had made his presence known, and the crime was discovered. A sad business, Zanis thought. The moneylenders preyed on the waterfront laborers like hawks on pigeons. Zanis looked at his watch, 3:39, and settled down to wait. This was a meeting, of course, and somebody was going to show up sooner or later. If he was dumb enough to walk past the idling Skoda, they'd get both of them. If not, just the German, though Saltiel would likely take off after the second man. Woman? Maybe. Anything was possible. 3:48 a.m. Hurry up, you bastards. Have your fucking meeting and let me go home to bed. After a rest and a trip to the police station where they'd get what they could, then run him back to the ship. After all, he hadn't done much. Entered Salonika without having his passport stamped. No point in keeping him. The German consul would squawk. Vangelis would be irritated. The hell with it. 4 a.m. What was the German doing down there? Was there a way through to another street that Zanis didn't know about? Oh, a fine thing that would be. I stood there until dawn, but I never saw him again. Zanis sighed, lifted his wet foot, shifted from his wet foot to his dry one, and thought about Roxanne, about making love, which was what they did. Sure, a restaurant now and suddenly... His mind snapped back to full attention. From the other end of the street, at a corner of a distant alley, headlights. No car yet, just beams probing the mist. What? Could you get through down there? Zanis didn't know, but obviously somebody did because the lights swung left into the street and now pointed directly at him. He scurried along the iron shutter to the opposite corner and wound up facing the Skoda. What would Saltiel do? Nothing. The lights stayed off. And next, he thought, addressing the unseen driver of the car, you'll turn into the alley. It was a Renault sedan that muttered past him, going very slowly, but his prediction was off. The Renault paused at the alley, moved forward a few feet, and backed in. Clever, Zanis thought, ready for a fast getaway. What was this? Another murder in the alley? Was it cursed? Was this long, boring, stupid night going to end in melodrama? Whatever happened down there didn't take long. It happened in the alley, and it happened quickly, and it happened where Zanis couldn't see it. A car door slammed, an engine roared, and the Renault reappeared, taking a fast left turn into the street and speeding off. Zanis squinted into the rain, trying to see through the cloudy rear window. Someone in the passenger seat? No, he didn't think so. As he hurried down the steps from the loading dock, he watched the Renault as it flew past the Skoda. Then the Skoda's lights came on, and Saltiel made a nice, easy turn and followed the Renault, which had turned east up the deserted corniche. As Zanis approached the alley, the German came out. They stopped dead, facing each other, maybe 30 feet apart. Then the German, like Hamid the moneylender, went scuttling back down the alley. Heading for the wisteria vine? No, he had a better idea, because by the time Zanis entered the alley, he'd disappeared. The magic German... Where? Zanis trotted along the sheer wall, very tense about some sort of unseen cover at his back, very certain that he was about to be shot. But then, just at the foot of the alley, a door. A door that, he guessed, would lead into the office of the warehouse. Had he forgotten it? Had it even been there back then? Walther. Yes, the time had come. Work the slide, arm it, assume Gabby kept it loaded... Assume he'd put the bullets back in the clip when he'd got done hanging up his picture. For he'd truly unloaded it, knowing full well that banging loaded weapons on hard surfaces wasn't such a good idea. The very least you could hope for was embarrassment, and it got quickly worse from there. Grandpa, the cat! No, Gabby had done the right thing because Gabby always did the right thing. Zanis closed the umbrella, set it by the wall, freed the Walther's clip, found it fully loaded, and locked it back in place. Then he stood to one side of the door and, making sure of his balance, raised his foot and kicked at the knob, intending to make it rattle on the other side. No bullets from inside, so he reached over, turned the knob, and opened the door. Unlocked. Always unlocked? Unlocked at the moment. Keeping to the cover of the wall as much as he could, he swung the door wide, waited a beat, then rushed in low. Walther pointed ahead of him. He'd expected an office and hoped for a telephone. Right, then wrong. It was an office, open to the warehouse floor. Filing cabinets, two desks, and an old-fashioned telephone. No dial, on the wall. But the line had been cut a few inches below the wooden box. Cut years ago, or cut 30 seconds ago? He didn't know. But he did know where he was. The Albala Spice Warehouse. The air was thick with scent. A dense compound of fennel, opium poppies, foul silk cocoons, and Mediterranean herbs, sage and thyme and the rest, stacked in burlap-covered bales and wooden crates out in the darkness, ready to be shipped. He listened for a time, but heard only silence, then waited, hoping his eyes would adjust to the darkness, but the only light in the warehouse seeped through closed louvers set high on the walls. One hand ahead of him, he moved forward, but he knew it was hopeless. He wasn't going to find the German crouched behind a bale of fennel. So he returned to the office, took hold of the door handle, and slammed it shut, then walked out into the darkness, making no attempt to move quietly. Something moved, something much bigger than a rat. The sound, weight shifting on boards, came from above him. He waited, changed gun hands, and wiped his sweaty palm on his pants leg. Again he heard it, almost directly above his head. So, the second floor. How did one get up there? No idea. He reached in his pocket, lit a match, discovered he was in an aisle with stacked bales on both sides. Lighting a second match, he saw what looked like a stairway on the far wall. It wasn't a stairway, but a wooden ramp, and when he got there, he found what he was looking for. At the foot of the ramp was a metal cabinet with a lever affixed to one side. He pulled the lever down, and the lights went on. Not a lot of light, a few bare bulbs and outlets screwed to the boards of the ceiling, and only on the first floor, but enough. Whatever was up there moved again, fast, running, then stopped. Zanis was finding it hard to breathe. How the hell did people work in here? The air was so charged, so chemically sharp, his eyes were watering, and he had to take his glasses off and wipe away the tears. Then, in a crouch, he scurried up the ramp and dove flat at the top, his head just below floor level. Quickly, he raised up to get a look, but even with some ambient light from the first floor, the gloom at the top of the ramp quickly faded into darkness. He sniffed. This place was really reaching him. Then spoke, not loud and not angry, in German. "Sir, please come out from wherever you're hiding and let me see your hands. Please, you won't be harmed." That did it. Running footsteps on the far side of the second floor, then a series of thumps punctuated by a cry of panic and, after a few beats of silence, a moan. Using two matches to reach the opposite wall, Zanis realized what had happened. There was another ramp over there, but if you didn't want to use it, there was an alternative. A square cut in the floor with a narrow and very steep set of stairs, almost a ladder, that descended to the floor below. The German's descent had clearly taken him by surprise, and he was lying face down with his head on the boards and his feet on the steps above. Zanis saw that he was wearing green socks, briefcase still clutched in one hand. Carefully, Walther still ready for use, Zanis walked down the stairs. The German said something. It sounded as though he were pleading, but his voice was muffled, and Zanis couldn't make out the words. He checked for weapons, found none, then took the German under the arms, turned him over, hauled him upright, and managed to get him seated on a step. For a moment, he just sat there, eyes shut, nose bleeding, then pressed a hand to the center of his chest and said, "Hospital, hospital." Thank you. Thanks. I'll be happy to take questions, but you have to wait till people come around with a microphone. Who would like to start? Don't tell me you've been listening to this and not thinking up great questions. I usually tell people to do that. I forgot. Dodie, Odie, yes.
In your books, you go into such great detail, especially some of the minutia about the different kind of cigarettes that they smoked at that time. How do you research some of the really intimate small items that you describe so well.
I do a lot of reading about the period, contemporaneous reading, both political and otherwise. And as you, if you read enough, if you're willing to read 250 pages and take away 8 words, if you're that crazy, as am I, then you will pick up details. I never saw the Papastratos number 1, which is the real Greek cigarette of the period. Salonika was basically a tobacco growing area, and they exported tobacco. I found it somewhere and used it, and that's always true. You don't find it often because people don't think it's worth mentioning at the time, because they think of it in terms of like Marlboros. That's what people have always smoked, do smoke, will always smoke. Why bother mentioning it? Yes, sir. We have to wait.
Have you visited Salonika to do the research?
I did visit Salonika. Normally, I don't do this because I lived in Europe for a long time and saw a lot of different places and basically got a good feel for Central Europe, Eastern Europe, and Western Europe. However, Salonika is very different, and Greece is different, and I'd never been in Greece. So I did go and visit Salonika quickly just to see what it might be like. Yes, sir.
For your book, The Spies of Warsaw, I listened to it unabridged on CD going back and forth to work, and I'm wondering what input do you have on the commentator and his or her interpretation of the book as they present it to the reader?
I'm going to have to admit I never listened to it. Well, I'm on my third reader. I did listen to the first one, who was Charles Goodell, who was a very good guy, and he used to call me and ask me what I wanted pronounced right, and I would tell him what I also wanted pronounced wrong. Trust me. Okay. And then Alfredo Molina did a couple of them. How cool is that? And now they have a new person. I don't know what they do. There's a producer at Simon & Schuster Audio. This is the person who's responsible for it. I have no say. Yes, sir.
It's wonderful.
Thank you.
I've read many of your books, and I notice in almost every one of them, there is the following. Alleys, mist, darkness, smog, freighters, no sunshine, no explicit sex, rain, very, very little explicit violence, rats, warehouses, small arms, and gloom. Now, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that all of those negatives are a metaphor for the scene you're trying to paint, that these were gloomy, miserable times, and these were gloomy, miserable people.
No, I accept the first half.
Okay.
I accept the first half. And I don't know about your explicit sex, but... there's plenty of stuff in here. I mean, really, sir? I try and I try. I think, honestly, my own experience of Europe and the experience of Europe to be found in the black and white film of the 30s, for whatever reason, really suggests that the place kind of felt like that. The parts of it that remain, that you can still go to, for example, the Hotel du Nord of the film by Marcel Carnet is still there, and it has that feeling. And it's right across from what I would call the marshalling yards, freight yards, and they have that feeling. And there, Europe is gray, Paris is gray. In fact, the gray of Paris has a name. It's called Le Grisaille. And in fact, if you go to an art supply store in Paris, you will find you cannot buy Payne's gray. They can't keep it in stock. So in a sense, America, Australia, the colonies, are rather more bright and sunny places which believe in rather more bright and sunny personalities.
whereas. Europe of that period, people did have a certain darkness to them. And what's more, what happened in 1914 really just destroyed those societies. And they never recovered even as World War II came on. So, yeah, there's atmosphere in the book, and yes, there's gloom, and yes, there's fog. But fog in Europe is beautiful. Look at, you know, just look at any of the black and white photos of the period. There's always halos around the street lamps. And in the city of Paris outside my apartment, there were halos around the street lamps. To my delight, I would have put them there anyhow. You're not wrong. Okay? But it is like that. Yes. This gentleman here, the man in the straw hat.
How would you compare yourself to Eric Ambler?
A fawning acolyte. I mean, I can only tell you that my copy of A Coffin for Demetrius, which is a very old paperback, has on the inside of the back cover in flow pen the first paragraph of Night Soldiers, which is the first book in this series, written on an airplane. It's really meant everything to me. He's the one who invented this. He just didn't do enough of it. He did some of it, but he didn't do enough of it. For me, I just simply love those books far more than Graham Greene or any of these other people. I really like Ambler. He's the best. Yes.
One thing I've noted in all of your books and in Eric Ambler's books is the underlying continuous theme of espionage. Almost to the extent that I can feel that you have to have some background that we don't know about.
Unless I don't know about it either. That's really clandestine. No, I don't. I will say I have some feel for it, and I have some understanding of it. And when I first actually read about it, I had read James Bond, I could care less, I had no interest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I did read a book which had an appendix in it, and the appendix discussed some operatives from the Soviet Union and how they went about doing what they did. And when I read that, I had like an experience. And I said, oh my God, this is about having lunch. This is not about fountain pens that shoot darts. It's really about having lunch. And I found that extremely interesting, because I found it a kind of psychic warfare, call it what you will. But this really did have to do with humans trying to deal with each other.
I believe that in Dark Star, I hope I have the right book, there's a strong implication that Stalin's purge of the old line Jewish Bolsheviks was in part a way of getting the Germans to warm up for the Hitler-Stalin pact and make it credible. I hope I have this right. And I'm wondering what evidence you have that that is the case, or do I not?
I have no evidence of it. I don't think it's true. And I don't hope I didn't say it. It might have
I don't think you said it, but I think
not,
it was implied.
Because as I understand it, there comes a moment in Dark Star when somebody says, this isn't a purge, it's a pogrom. And the reason it was a pogrom is that he killed off all the Jews, of which were legion, within the Bolshevik upper classes of the intelligence service and of the government. All those guys, Kamenev and all these people, those are all false names.
Yeah.
They were all named Goldstein.
Right. But you have it happening simultaneously with a approach.
It did happen that
approaches.
Way, but I don't think that's why it happened. As I understand it, nobody really knows why.
Yeah.
Nobody really knows why. I think Stalin was paranoid. I think he thought he deserved to be murdered. After the attack of Barbarossa, June 21st, when the Soviet Union was not prepared, when they came to his office, he thought they were going to kill him. Instead, they said, oh, noble leader, you must lead us. So he killed a bunch more people.
Right.
But basically, Stalin spoke Russian with an accent. Just as, you know, Hitler wasn't a German, he was an Austrian. Stalin wasn't a Russian, he was a Georgian. And I think he wanted fellow Georgians like Beria. That's how Beria got in. I could go on and on. Stop. Stop, Alan. Thank you. Yes, next question or last question. Yes.
Why does this particular period of time continue to call to you?
I don't know what it is about it. I think for one thing, it's a great period for novels in that it's really good versus evil. And nobody has any question about who's the good and who's the evil. A. B. This period was so intense and so violent and such a cataclysm that normal people basically had four choices. You could be a victim, you could be a fugitive, you could be a hero, or you could be a villain. And there wasn't much else available. You could not get out of the way. And in this period, for whatever reason, there is enormous nobility in humans. People just felt they were quite idealistic about it, some of the better ones. And I don't think the better ones really survived. But there's something about the period. All right, that's a rational answer for this evening, and now I'll tell you something else. When I moved to Paris to write these books, I didn't have I had no music. So I went out and I bought a boombox. I had no cassettes. So I went to the store and I bought Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli, recorded by the Hot Club of France one February night in Paris in 1937. When I put that on, before the music ever came on, when the MC spoke, when people coughed, and I heard them, I thought, that right there, that's what I want. Those people that night, and all the hair on the back of my neck stood up. So I knew I'd made the right choice. Hey, thank you so very much for coming. I'm going to sign books, but I don't know where. Where do I sign books in heaven. Where? You'll have to wait. Maybe not long, but. Oh, they know where to go. Okay.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.